All right, let's start. As usual, let me start by asking for your comments on the chapter, and then I've got various things I can discuss within it and related to it. But to begin with, subject for today is mechanisms for enforcing legal rules. We've seen quite a wide range of them, I think a wider range than most people are familiar with, and what interesting lessons do we draw about the alternative mechanisms and the ways you the advantages and disadvantages and so forth. So did any of you have, having read the chapter, comments, questions, whatever?
So I was really struck by the idea that your analysis on reputation, reputation enforcement takes place by spreading information about bad behavior, information that makes it in the interest of someone to recognize who seems to modify their actions in a way that imposes costs on people who behave badly. So reputation is a subject that's near and dear to my heart. Are there other areas in which reputation is actually used in society? I mean, it seems like an underused system, at least within governmental levels.
From a governmental level, I would have said that large parts of our economy really are driven by that. That I just if you think about sort of more generally why stores rarely cheat their customers, are often quite generous and helpful. If any of you want to buy a camera, there is a camera store on Winchester and Hamilton, I think is the corner, San Jose Video or something like that, and I can report the experience of going into them and saying, I've got a whole lot of slides I'd like to turn into computer pictures. You sell gadgets designed to scan slides, what would you advise? And after I described my situation, the advice I got was don't buy one of these gadgets. You can do a better job at a lower cost by simply sending them in to one of a variety of services, not through us, which will scan your slides for you. Well, the fact that they were willing to advise me against their interest is a reason to trust them, right? And I, therefore, I do trust them. So that would be sort of one example. I think there are a lot of other examples of that sort that
I would agree that the economy's worried about that, but what about it seems like reputation is a possible strategy for functioning, for getting government to work without using
I don't know about governments working, but it seems to me that if you think about the political system, that internally to the system reputational enforcement has to be very important. Because the question, look, politicians are making bargains with each other all the time. I will vote for this if you vote for that. What enforces those bargains? They're not legal bargains. They're not enforceable in a court. What's the definition of an honest politician? An honest politician is one who stays bought. That's right. And it's clear that there's a real incentive in that market, precisely in part because you can't use legal enforcement to have that reputation. And I suspect there are a lot of other cases like that. So I don't know. How were you thinking, or how would you modify our legal system to better rely on reputation?
Well, specifically, I'm thinking about in the modern world, and specifically in Amazon reviews and Reddit, people now get to vote on whether or not they think a particular review, comments, news story, etc., is worthy of being bubbling to the top.
Yes.
So by virtue of this, you can essentially imagine people who are consistently, I mean, this is what was proposed, I think, by David Brin and Burr. You can imagine people that routinely get it right in their analyses of X, and as a consequence, they gain a larger reputation. And now you can imagine giving these people sort of broader authority to actually make rules or decisions.
Well, except that who is it that is, why do you need to? If they've got the reputation, then doesn't that mean that people will take their advice without that authority? My friend Robin Hanson came up with this neat idea a long time ago for information markets, where his idea is basically, I've discussed this before, but you have a question that you'd like an sort of objective answer to, like, is global warming going to raise the temperature of the Earth by a degree in the next 10 years? Which is too high. Let's take that as an example. And so you say, how do we get the information? We create a security which will pay $100 in 10 years if the mean temperature of the Earth defined in some ways at least a degree higher than it now is, and nothing if it isn't. And we allow people to sell and buy these securities. We're just creating a definition, in effect. So that means that you're betting. If you are confident that global warming is all fake, you are perfectly willing to sell these securities at any price much above zero. if you're sure that global warming is real and rapid, you're willing to buy them at any price much below $100. Initially, we have the enthusiasts. And let us say the price turns out to be $20. But now you're a professional speculator. So what you do is to get good, reliable information, hiring experts who are working for you, not for any political movement or whatever. And you decide the odds are 50%. Up to 50% at $20, those securities are a steal. So you buy them. And if enough experts come into that market, after a while, the market price reflects the real probability. As calculated out, people who lose money if they get it wrong. That was Robin's idea. His basic insight was that ordinary markets like the stock market or the future market have as their main purpose allocating capital, you know, hedging risks and so forth, but as a sort of a side effect, they generate information. Because people observing those markets can say, look, this company's strategy must be great, look how much their stock has shot up. And other things of that sort. Or they can say, look, we can get a good prediction of the price of gasoline a year from now by looking at what future markets are saying now. And so Robin wanted to deliberately employ that mechanism for that purpose. And as you may know, there are some markets now what? I would say that now that work on that basis, especially for the political gambles. And I'm not sure. I think the original one was in the U.S., and got around the legal restrictions on gambling because it was an academic project. But I think the large-scale stuff is now outside the U.S. for doing that. But that's an example. It's not exactly reputation in the same sense, but it's, again, a way of getting of generating information not by having the government generate information, but by having institutions that themselves generate the information. Because I'm not sure I see how your idea either works or makes sense, because once you set up your system, now people have an incentive to game the system to get that they're the ones who make the rules, however you define the reputation. And of course, with the Amazon case, it's interesting because, of course, there are obviously problems with that. I don't know if I discussed in this class the talk I heard by somebody who claimed to have successfully gamed the Amazon Kindle system. As he described it, he wrote, I think, a historical novel. And he had established a network of, I suppose, 100 or 200 fans online. And he then asks all of his fans to each buy one copy of the Kindle of his novel, or maybe his next novel, I'm not sure, which costs $3 or something, at the same time on the same day. And Amazon lists for every Kindle its ranking among their Kindles in terms of sales. And apparently that ranking is heavily weighted to the immediate time period. So his claim was that by doing that, he pushed his ranking up to number one on Amazon, like for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but wait a minute. For those 30 minutes, anybody who was saying, huh, I wonder if people are reading on Amazon, let's look at the first 10, the top 10 things. His is at the top, let's try that. And so his claim was that as long as your book was reasonably good, good enough so that if lots of people read it, some of them would like it, you could then get yourself fairly high in the ratings in the long term. That's what he claimed, at least, to be done. You know, I didn't. Well, except that it's a system which is rewarding that kind of organization as opposed to having good books. That I know what I've been arguing, this is really more my other seminar than this one, but I've been arguing for some time that the current technology makes it almost completely replaces publishers. That is, if you ask, what does a publisher contribute to producing a book? Well, the publisher contributes copy editing. The copy editing is done by freelancers anyway, and the author or the author's agent could hire the copy editor just as easily. Some publishers sometimes contribute useful editing. In terms of my experience, it's been very mixed as to whether my book was actually improved by the editor's contribution, and the very best editing I've ever gotten in my life was from my agent, not from an editor, who went over the first chapter of what ended up as my most successful book, making suggestions as to how to make it pull in the reader better. And they were good suggestions. So that's not really essential. The one physical production and distribution used to be the central requirement. But as you may know, you can not only get a Kindle up on Amazon at no cost at all, you can get a physical bound paperback book that looks just like the ones you buy in the bookstore up on Amazon for a total cost of well under $100. Because I've done it twice now. There is a subsidiary of Amazon called CreateSpace. There are other firms that do it, but they're the ones I've dealt with. And basically, you send them in a PDF of the interior of your book, a PDF of the cover of your book. they print out a copy and send it to you as a proof copy. You go over it and find out what's wrong. You revise your two PDFs. You keep doing this until you're happy. I'm not sure they still charge you anything. When I originally did it, I think they charged you $30 or $35 to get their better pricing list. You could do it without paying that, but then the royalties you got were much less. And other than that, the only cost was the cost of buying and having mailed the proof copies, which is like $5 or $10 a throw, depending how many times you go through the humiliating experience of discovering that after you thought you had eliminated all the errors, there are still errors left to be eliminated. So it's not quite easy if you want to write. It used to be that self-publishing was called vanity press. And what was basically going on was that you wanted to be able to tell your friends that you were a published novelist. And you paid for it. So the standard vanity press deal, you paid them a bunch of the cost. You agreed to buy some number of copies of the books that you then tried to get your friends and relatives to buy off you, or you gave away for Christmas or something. You ended up spending some notice of money. It might be worth it from your standpoint, but it was really a fraud. It was really a way of claiming the status of being a novelist without actually having written a novel that anybody wanted to publish. Nowadays, it's still true that if you self-publish your novel, you don't have much basis for claiming to be a novelist any more than if it was sitting in your desk drawer as a stack of paper, pieces of paper. But you can now do it at essentially very close to zero cost. And that suggests the possibility of a future where instead of submitting your book to the slush pile of a publisher, you submit it to the slush pile of the world. That is to say, you self-publish it. And then the missing link in that system is a good way of filtering. That the publishers don't do it very well, but they probably eliminate the bottom 90% of the books that people write. Certainly for fiction, maybe even more than the bottom 90%. And the fact that a book is published by a reputable publisher doesn't mean you want to read it. You probably don't, but it's a whole lot more likely than the fact that the author thought it was worth publishing. So what you need is a better mechanism, and that's what Amazon reviews and Amazon sales rating are trying to do, but they don't do it very successfully from the evidence I can see. So if any of you want to make the world a better place and make yourself rich, if you can come up with a workable mechanism by which you can let people figure out which books they ought to read and get paid for doing some of that, obviously that's it. In some way, you've got to get paid if you want to make yourself rich doing it. I think that's sort of a market niche that is badly in need of filling. I've got a scheme for Amazon to do it, which probably wouldn't work, but might, and which I think I've discussed on my blog in the past, but someone else is going to come up with some different scheme, which eventually will work, I think, I hope. So, anyway, that's a long digression, but it's relevant to the course, because although what you're enforcing, what you're using reputation for there is not enforcing legal rules, but it's doing one of the sorts of things that legal rules try to do, determine what's high quality, low quality. If you think about things like the FDA and licensing of physicians and so forth, and it's doing it in a different mechanism. So that I think is actually potentially quite interesting. Yes. Yes. Yes.
But I had always was thinking that conflict was really based a lot into the two parties harming each other to some extent, and not necessarily.
I think if you actually read up on it, the two parties are much less clearly defined than the sort of pop story makes it look. That some of the people on the Hatfield side are named McCoy, and the people on the McCoy side are named Hatfield. These two families have been intermarrying like for 100 years. They're living fairly close to each other. As I think I mentioned, at one point there's a lawsuit, and it's the judge of the defendant's family of the plaintiff's family, I think, acquits the defendant, if I remember correctly. So they say, thank you. So I don't think it was that sharp. I'm sure that, there are individuals who grudge, and there's one sort of Romeo and Juliet bit of the story, which I didn't discuss because it wasn't relevant to what I was talking about, but where you have a love affair between someone who is supposedly Hatfield and someone who is supposedly McCoy, But as far as I can remember, I think the only place it really gets entangled in the feud is that at some point I think she warns her lover, boyfriend, whatever he is at that point, of something that her brothers or someone else in the family is planning to do, an attack of some sort. It's long enough ago, as I don't remember, and it's been romanticized in the story. And they don't end up marrying, as I remember. I think that may be a case where her family disapproves or his family disapproves. But it doesn't look like a very, you know, serious... It doesn't look as though the families really think of themselves as enemies for 100 years and keep on doing nasty things to each other. And also, it's all getting entangled in politics, because it's pretty clear that part of what's going on, if you look at that story, is that one family is politically influential in one of the two adjacent states and one in the other adjacent state, and that's getting involved with these conflicts.
I guess I was thinking the idea of fatal wounding.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like it's necessary.
Yes.
To deter the other party.
That's right. And if you think about if we think about the Kale Gypsies, there it looks as though the feuding is mostly avoidance. And that is a cost, having some of the people who won't do business with you. Your son can't court their daughter, even though you're officially not courting anybody, but stuff like that. So I think that's right. And I think if you think about the sort of lower level feuding that really is a part of the background of our society, even though we don't call it that, where you say, you know, so and so treated me badly. So what do I do? Well, I'm not going to, you know, take an axe to him. But I'm not going to do any favors for him. And, you know, maybe if I can give advice to someone else that'll hurt him, maybe I'll find... But you can think I need a whole lot of sort of short of explicit use of violence and stuff, which in its logical structure is a feud system, even if it isn't actually using violence to enforce rules. And, I mean, that's part of the point I make about norms when I'm saying, you know, why is it that I would be unwilling, aside from the temperature, to teach this class naked to the waist? That violates no U.S. law that I know of. I, in fact, once had a colleague long ago at BPI. He used to partially strip in the course of an economics lecture as a way of getting the students' attention, and he was sort of a performer, as it were, kind of person, quite a successful lecturer, I gather. But I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't do it in part because of the recognition that I would lose status, that people would say, what kind of a nutty guy is that Friedman? He does things like this. You can even see it in weaker forms. One of the reviews of my law's order is by somebody who starts off saying, I thought I heard this Friedman was this nutty anarchist guy. Seems like a perfectly ordinary law and econ book to me. That was sort of amusing to see the way in which the fact that on that particular issue I held a very minority opinion, namely the ideal society we get along with no government at all, results in some reputational costs and benefits, probably. It also gives you additional visibility. There aren't many people arguing that position, after all, and so forth. So, you know, I think there's a lot of that sort of stuff going on in the background, and that's also one of the interesting things, even if it's not the official legal system. Other people? Yeah. Yes. No, you were?
Oh, okay. So I've kind of written a hot question, because, so when you talk about these systems, you kind of focused on how they relied on commitment mechanisms. That if you didn't have structured kinship or like structured who you lived with, then the feud system wouldn't make a lot of sense, because then you wouldn't have that.
Wouldn't have to be kinship, though.
He's arguing the revenge, just to be,
that is to say,
actually, no.
If they actually kill you, then revenge doesn't work. But a feud system without any kinship ties, as long as the injury is short of killing you, could still work, just because you then go to a lot of trouble to hurt them. Right? So it's true. If they're going to kill you, you need a tie to someone who's still going to be alive in order to revenge you. But it doesn't even have to be kinship. That, for example, in the sagas, you get fictitious kinship. You get, there's one case, it's not quite few, but it's the same sort of thing in Egil's saga. In fact, there are two cases going both ways. Egil has a blood brother, Arinbjorn. And Arinbjorn, who's not related to him. And at one point, Egil is traveling in Norway, and he visits Arinbjorn's sister. Arinbjorn is somewhere else at that point. And she's really upset. And why is she upset? He finally gets it out of her. Because there is a berserker who has claimed their land and demanded trial by combat. And the only male available in the family is her son, who's like 17 or something. And Egil says, I'll take care of this. And so he volunteers. He basically challenges the Berserker to trial by combat. And Egil, if you read Egil's saga, you get the feeling that Egil is what Berserkers are pretending to be, if that makes any sense. So Egil is fighting this Berserker. And the Berserker can't do anything to Egil. He's a very able warrior. The trouble is that when Egil hits Berserker with his sword, the blade won't bite. It's as if there's a magic somehow that's protecting the Berserker. And eventually Egil gets bored with all this, so he throws down his sword, throws down his shield, throws down the Berserker, and bites his throat out. End of fight. Much, much later in the saga, Egil is shipwrecked in northern England. And he asks around what the situation is, and he's told that northern England is currently... he's going to visit the Anglo-Saxon king, who's a friend of his, who he's fought for before, but he doesn't make it. That northern England is being run underneath the Anglo-Saxon king by a Norwegian by the name of Eric Bloodaxe, who was one of the sons of the king of Norway, who's no longer alive and got driven out of Norway by his brothers in the course of succession feud, essentially. Egil and Harald Bloodaxe Eric Bloodaxe are not friends, to put it mildly. And that, in fact, Egil's family has been running a family feud with the king of Norway and his descendants for a couple of generations, which sounds interesting, but if you read Egil's saga, you begin to appreciate that Egil and his father and grandfather are fairly able people, even though they're not kings, and they've carried off their half the feud pretty well. So what's Egil going to do? Egil is 6 feet tall, bald, ugly, and famous, and he's got a bunch of men with him. Walking out of northern England with nobody noticing is going to be hard. Instead, he goes to York, which is where Eric Bloodaxe is, because with Eric Bloodaxe is Arinbjorn, who is one of Eric Bloodaxe's retainers, one of his chief sort of second-in-command types. And so Egil goes to Arinbjorn's hall and with the idea of getting Arinbjorn to help out. And there's this great scene where Egil meets somebody outside Arinbjorn's hall. And he says, could you go and ask Arinbjorn if he'd rather talk to Egil Skalla Grimson inside the hall or out? And the guy goes in the hall and yells the length of the hall, hey, Arinbjorn, there's this guy out here. He is a man. He looks more like a troll to me. Who wants to know if you'd rather talk to Egil Skalla Grimson inside the house or out? So at that point, he's blown any possibility of secrecy. And they end up... agreeing to go to Eric's hall, and Arinbjorn gives this speech to Eric about how great it is when a man like him is so famous that his enemies come to his hall to make peace with him. And Eric might buy that, it's not clear, but Eric's wife, who is an unpleasant lady, I think it's suggested she's Finnish, and therefore perhaps knows more about certain things than she ought to, is quite unwilling to accept this and keeps telling Eric, look, if you've got a chance finally to get Egil. If you let him get away now after all that he's done to you and your relatives, what will people think of you? And eventually Arinbjorn says to Eric, you know, look, Eric, you're not going to get any reputation killing an Icelandic farmer and a handful of his men. So if you really insist on fighting him just to make it an interesting fight, me and my men will fight on his side. And presumably Eric would still win. But having been driven out of Norway, he doesn't really want to have two-thirds of his men fight the other third and, you know, get a bunch of them killed. So that sort of at least slows things down. But again, Eric's wife is still arguing on the other side. And finally, Arinbjorn says, look, Eric, it's night out. It's dark. Everybody knows that night killing is murder. All right? Murder is secret killing, which is shameful in the Norse system. Now, it would not be in the least secret at this point that Eric killed Egil, but symbolically it is. And, of course, presumably Eric would also like to find a way out of the situation. And so they agree that Egil will go off with Arinbjorn, and Arinbjorn will guarantee to bring him back in the morning. And they go off and consult. And Egil, in addition to being a famous warrior, is a famous poet. And so what they agree on is that Egil will write a poem in praise of Eric Bloodaxe and offer it as ransom for his head. And in fact, the title of the poem is Head Ransom. And so Arinbjorn puts Egil in a room in his house, in his hall, and to compose the poem. And pretty clearly he's composing it in his head. I don't think he's doing written poetry at all. And in half the night's gone by, and Arinbjorn comes back in, and he says, how's it going? And Egil says, I can't get a verse written. There's a bird that keeps coming and pecking at the window frame and disturbing me. And Arinbjorn goes out And as he goes out, he sees a shape changer go by. Not explain what this means, how he knows it. And the rest of the night, the obvious implication is the queen, not the queen, but Eric's wife. And the rest of the night, Arinbjorn stands outside the window while Egil inside is composing what becomes a very famous poem. And in the morning, they go to Eric's hall. Egil offers the poem as the payment for his life. Eric accepts. Egil goes off again. So Arinbjorn and Egil, you can see, are in effect trading favors, fairly expensive favors, especially in the second case, back and forth, even though they're not related. So that's a system in which you're using adoptive kinship for that purpose.
What I've been looking into is the hunter-gatherer.
These fins, you know. Yeah.
And they don't have rigid kinship in that
yes.
same way, where what they have in when feuds erupt is that it's kind of like a safety valve. No one necessarily has to live near each other if they don't want to, because you can essentially go anywhere you want, and then by what your name is, you can then adopt kinship in that area. And so as a safety valve, it appears to be a kinship or a feud system that functions entirely without commitment.
So is it avoidance, or are they fighting each other?
They'll fight each other until it's decided that it's just easier to live away from each other. Because if you, subsistence is
significant. Because the Roman Shawl, after all, the implication of the chapter that discussed the Roman Shawl was that if you weren't willing to either fight or pay off, you left.
Right.
So in that sense, avoidance is a fairly natural safety valve for a feud system.
Okay.
But what is the incentive? Suppose you kill somebody, what happens to you?
There's kind of the other side wants.
What's the other side? You're saying there's no kinship. What's the structure that gives somebody an incentive to revenge you?
But it's constantly there. It's all explained in the paper.
But it's fictitious kinship.
There's three layers of kinship. There's the kinship you actually have, the kinship based on your name, and this concept where the older person of the two people meeting is deciding what the kinship is.
Interesting, yes. But so however that system works,
right.
When someone kills me, there are people who think of themselves as my kin.
Right.
And are they committed to now take action against my killer?
They have the option of completely ignoring it and letting it just pass. Or they describe it as kind of like an accepted execution where you can kill the person who did the killing and then it's all just done.
Yes. Well, that's true. That's, I think, the Comanche version as well, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
That there are some of these systems. The Kali have what seems like a poorly designed system where when you kill the person who does the killing, now his side owes you one. Now they want to kill one of yours. But I think the Comanche system, it seems to me the obvious sensible way of doing it, is that one killing each side, it's balanced and it's over. But there still seems to be, the system isn't going to work unless when I'm thinking about killing you, I think there's a sizable chance that your kin will come after me.
From the studies I've been reading, it appears that that's actually a very extraordinary case. Most killings are one killing happens, and then both sides like go to different go to different living areas, and then they just never see each other again.
So if that's again, that's a little bit like the Kali avoidance system, and maybe that's a significant cost. I don't know, because after all, why do I have to go to another one? Why, if I'm not committed, why don't I just stay in my own place where I know where the food is to be found and stuff?
And that appears to be what happens in most scenarios.
Then nothing happens.
Right. They accept it as a fight between two individuals.
Yeah, well, I guess that's all right if the circumstances are such that the only way I can kill you involves a sizable risk of getting killed myself. Which works for reasonably even ones. It doesn't work if I and six of my buddies ambush you, for example. Is that happening or not?
That appears to be the only time multiple people are in a fight is if you start a fight in the middle of an area and accidentally hit somebody nearby, then they'll get angry also.
Yeah. Right. Right. All right. Interesting. Other people? Things they've turned up in their research or ideas or questions?
Yeah. I was thinking about divine retribution.
Yes.
Up until the point where Benjamin Franklin discovers the lightning rod, churches in England and in the colonies were built in a fashion that they actually were more attractive to lightning than otherwise. And I'm wondering if this might actually be sort of a type of demonstration on the part of the churches that God does in fact strike people down for sinfulness, and so they're essentially willing to take the cost
occasionally destroy churches, in the benefit is a more faithful congregation.
Except that presumably the amount of lightning is going to be the same either way, which is where it hits, right? And so, doesn't hitting the church make a worse argument because the church is supposed to?
I think if you don't have the tall, I mean, the churches are quite a unique structure. It's very, very tall, and then they put the crosses on the top. So I think they're more likely to get struck than any other building.
I understand, but the question is the total number of
church, then they're likely to strike trees instead of houses at all. So no one gets hurt by that.
Uh-huh. Maybe. So if it strikes the church, it's grounding through the church steeple. Is that going to kill a person?
I think it damages and destroys the church.
It might damage the church, but I would have thought that the times when lightning kills people, it's when there's a person out by himself and he's the highest target, as it were, and the current goes through him. But no, that's it. I don't know if anybody has really done a careful study of sort of the way in which religion plays into legal systems in all sorts of different ones. That maybe I should suggest that to Peter Leeson for his next book or something, because he's done. I was talking about his ordeal stuff, and he's got a couple of other things which I found somewhat less convincing. He's got one on cursing and how he thinks that works, and he's got one. There were these weird cases in the Middle Ages where they had trials for animals. Where you had things like a plague of insects, and they would have a formal trial of the insects. And he has a theory, which I'm not sure I believe in, to try to explain why that worked. But maybe I could get him interested in the broader project of looking at across a wide range of societies and saying, how does religion play into making legal systems work? Because I'm sort of intrigued by this idea that maybe religion is really functional. And, you know, parts of that idea are an old idea. Whether it's true or not, for a moment, this is sort of orthogonal to whether it's true. There's the very old argument which says, well, it's functional because it gets people to act morally. There's this wonderful passage by Orwell, who pretty clearly was an atheist, and where he's talking, the way he puts it is that for the last 150 years, every man of ability has been an enemy of religion. They have been 100 years. And he says, of course, that was the right thing to do, because religion by that time had really just become sort of a fraud by which the rich kept the poor quiet kind of thing. But he says, we may have underestimated the consequences of what we've been doing. We have amputated the soul, and maybe it is not a minor operation like removing a bad tooth, that we have been sawing away on the branch on which we were sitting, and we have fallen not into a garden of roses, but a cesspool filled with barbed wire, which is the description of the first half of the 20th century, roughly. And it's a really neat passage, and it's pretty clear that what he's suggesting is that maybe, even though religion was a bad thing on net, religion was one of the things that made people not willing to consider solving the Jewish problem by killing all the Jews, and the equivalent, solving a whole bunch of other problems. And if you look at sort of the history, even in the 20th century, if you look at the issue of eugenics, I was discussing him actually in my other class, this famous Buck versus Bell, I think, this, you know, three generations of imbeciles are enough, Oliver Wendell Holmes quote, when there was a serious movement supported by a lot of people we think highly of, including Holmes, including Churchill, people left and right, saying that we've got to prevent the incompetent from reproducing. Who opposed it? And the answer is the Catholic Church opposed it. That it didn't happen in Catholic countries. Some other people opposed it, but they were probably the most important opposition. So that was okay, and I think they were right. If you look back at it, that the people who were doing it were much too arrogant in believing they knew sort of what decisions to make for other people. And it's a very pretty argument in theory, but it's not such a pretty argument when you start getting it down to the ground, deciding who you think is not entitled to reproduce. So you can make that argument, but then a particular subset of it, which I've been sort of touching at a number of times, is the way in which religious belief might be a useful tool for making the legal system work, because, among other things, it gives you a lie detector. You know, Cotty says to the plaintiff, yeah, it looks like you're right. Now, are you willing to swear that you're right? Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor. And that kind of mechanism in at least Muslim and Jewish law, and we've got the remnants of it in our system. I'm not sure how seriously you will take it, but supposedly you're swearing on a Bible that what you're saying is true. And there are probably parts of the country where that's a real constraint, where people really are, where the same... That would be an interesting question. I wonder if there are cases where the same policeman who would be willing to lie himself blue in the face in order to convict the guy we think is guilty but he doesn't have the evidence wouldn't do it if he had to swear on a Bible. I don't know. But you could certainly imagine constraints of that. So that's one interesting sort of thought that comes out of a bunch of this. Yeah.
You mentioned on the courts, you were talking about...
Yes. Well, that may depend on what categories of offenses you're thinking of as torts. Part of the context of this, one of the talks I like to give, I gave not that long ago, one of my favorite titles is Should We Abolish the Criminal Law? And what I'm basically asking there is, look, although people don't usually think about it, we've got these two different legal systems doing the same work, criminal law and tort law. How about if you just scrap one of them and turn it all over to the other? And when you start thinking about that, you're now going to include in torts the kind of offense where it's not obvious who did it. All right, so that one of the arguments, when I've argued some of this stuff with Posner in particular, and Landis, one of the arguments made on their side is tort works fine for cases where you know who did it, and the only argument about it is what are the legal implications, what are the damages, and so forth. But if you have a case where you can only expect to catch one guy out of five, and it's going to take a lot of effort to find that one guy out of five, now either you only make the victim good, in which case, on average, the tortfeasor is only paying a fifth of the damages, because most of the time he gets away, or you say, all right, he's going to have to pay five times as much, then he can't pay it, he's judgment proof, or then you have an incentive to fake torts in order to get it, a version of the people's worry about the tort system over rewarding through punitive damages and class actions and so forth. So that was their argument. Now, I didn't find it so convincing because it turned out that if you worked through their proof that the system that came out of Becker-Stigler and that I was then arguing for couldn't work, it turned out their proof applied to ordinary tort law too, although they didn't realize it. That they had an argument which purported to shift. Let me go back a couple of steps. Becker and Stigler wrote this neat article on the compensation of enforcers, in which they were arguing that the standard model of criminal law is not incentive compatible, because the value to the criminal of catching you is much less than the cost to you of being caught, and therefore the criminal has an incentive to sell out, to accept bribes, to burn the evidence, and you therefore need a more elaborate system to stop you. And they said, look, there's a simple and elegant solution. Let the payment to the policeman be equal to the punishment to the criminal. So turn it into a bounty system, as it were. And now the only bribe I'll take is if you agree to pay your full fine. That's fine. That saves us the trouble of the trial. It doesn't generate as much information as a trial might, but it saves us at least the trouble of it. And then Landis and Posner, in their response, pointed out a number of issues. And one of the issues is who has the right to catch the criminal and collect the fine. You could imagine, since in this system the policemen are really private actors doing it for their bounty, they're bounty hunters in effect rather than employees, how do we decide who gets to do it? And they said, well, one possibility is the victim of the crime owns the claim and he can transfer it to whom he likes. And you then realize that Becker and Stigler have unintentionally reinvented tort law. Because in tort law, the victim of the tort has a claim against the tortfeasor. He can't freely transfer it. We're behind the times relative to the Icelanders. But he can partially transfer it through a contingency fee and things of that sort. And then Landis and Posner came up with this very ingenious argument, which purported to show that that system could not be economically efficient. It couldn't be as good as a perfect publicly run system. And the argument was that when the legal system sets the fine for a crime, it is simultaneously setting two things. One of them is the punishment if you're convicted, and one of them is the reward if you catch somebody. But if you think through the logic of the system, if you imagine you're sort of trying to optimally, you don't want to catch everybody, that costs too much. You're making the optimum trade-off between probability of conviction and punishment. And I've got a long discussion of these other things I've published, that they argue there's no reason save chance why the same reward would give you the optimal probability and the optimal punishment. On the other hand, a perfectly run state system, you tell the police how hard to try to catch people, you set the punishment, you can get the optimal. And I then published two articles that came out of this thing, which is what really got me into doing law and econ. And one of them was on Iceland, because they really had a system of that sort. But the other was a theoretical argument in which I showed that if you made a small change in the institutions they assumed, you in fact solved their problem. That you got a situation in which the profit-maximizing decision of the firm that was buying the right to prosecute the offenses turned out to give them the incentive to choose the optimal probability punishment mix. People are curious. That paper is on my website. It's called Efficient Institutions for the Private Enforcement of Law. It's a little bit technical, but anybody who isn't seriously uncomfortable with mathematics can probably follow it. You might find it interesting. However, one of the things that occurred to me in doing that is that they had not only proved that you couldn't use tort law efficiently for crimes, you couldn't use it for torts either. Because the equivalent problem in tort law is the optimal expenditure on prosecution. That after all, tort cases aren't free. And on average, I think the figure I saw a long time ago was that about half the cost to the defendant is received by the plaintiff. The rest goes to the lawyers on both sides, basically. So there is some optimal probability, some optimal expenditure on proving that you're guilty of a tort, given that hopefully if we spend more, we're less likely to make mistakes, but it's a cost. Some optimal damage payment for you to owe when you're convicted. When the legal system sets the damages for an offense, it is simultaneously setting the incentive to convict you and the punishment. And there is no reason, Landis Posner argument runs right through, to suppose that the optimal level is the same. So they had accidentally proved that you shouldn't use tort for tort as well, which I thought was really quite neat. I don't know if I can do that. I may have convinced them of that. I'm not sure. I think
The idea is that you're putting a price on the final. You have to put a price on the
yes.
Criminal.
Yes. But we do that already. It's just that the price is only sometimes in money.
Yeah, but if it wasn't in money, in your hypothetical system, then there'd be no incentive for the police officer to...
Well, that's one of the issues, and there are a number of possible solutions. And from my standpoint, probably the most serious problem with replacing criminal law with tort law is the judge and proof defendant. And it's a problem for two different reasons. First, if the only punishment is paying damages, then the judge and proof defendant doesn't pay damages, so there's no punishment for him, so why shouldn't he commit the offense? All right, that's problem A. And problem B is, if I can't collect the damages, that eliminates my incentive to go after him, so therefore, even if he was going to be punished, somehow he never gets caught. And there are, it seems to me, two answers, at least, to that. One of them is what I think of as a hybrid system, and that's a system where the state says, look, each offense has both a money payment and an alternative non-monetary payment, like imprisonment or execution or flogging or whatever that legal system uses. If you can pay the money damage, you're home free. That's the tort version. If you can't pay the money damage or don't pay it, we don't have any way, it's basically the alternative is really a way of making sure that you only don't pay it if you can't, because it's not easy for us to know what your assets are. But if you don't pay it, then you spend 2 years in jail or you get flogged or we hang you or whatever that legal system sets up. Now we've eliminated half the problem. We now have deterrence even for people who can't pay damages. What about the incentive to prosecute? And then one answer...
Sorry, what about the...
incentive to prosecute. Why should the victim go after the guy if he doesn't expect to get any money? That's right. And there are then two possible answers. The hybrid answer is that the state not only locks you up, it pays a reward to the guy who convicted you. All right? So the state says, look, we no longer have to pay cops. Got all this money. We no longer have to pay DAs. We've made a big saving in a criminal case. Let's use some of the money to compensate those public-spirited people who convict what we used to call a criminal, with the result that we locked them up, they couldn't get their damage payment, we'll give them the damage payment. So that would be an interesting hybrid mechanism you can make. The other alternative is the English 18th century solution, in which the reason you go after them isn't for the payment at all, it's for the deterrence. So you then need mechanisms, the equivalent of the Prosecution Association in 18th century England mechanisms so that people who are thinking of committing crimes against you know whether you are pre-committed to prosecute. And now you've got an incentive to pre-commit to prosecute in order to deter people from crimes against you. Well, that's supposed to be the point of it. Arguably, you can argue that's the point of the criminal system anyway, to deter a thing. You just made it a private good instead of a public good. So those are two possible answers. And I don't want to claim that I am confident that this would work better than the present system. But I'm not at all confident it wouldn't. It seems to me that that one of the holes in the standard law school education, in a sense, is that everybody takes for granted the existing crime-tort distinction. They take for granted the rules of that distinction. Let me put this question to you. At any point in your education so far, has somebody put the question, why is it that criminal conviction requires intent and tort conviction does not? Ever asked? Yeah. Maybe they've asked the question, why is it that criminal conviction is beyond a reasonable doubt and tort conviction is preponderance of the evidence? They might discuss that, but if so, they probably gave you the wrong answer. Because has that question been discussed at some point? Why do we have the different standards of proof? What was the answer?
The stake. What? You have the potential to lose your liberty as opposed to...
That what?
That you have the potential to lose your liberty as opposed to just trying.
Except that we require proof beyond a reasonable doubt for offenses that are punished by fines as well. And we require a preponderance of the evidence for restraining orders, which restrict your liberty. That is, I would have said that the standard answer is that the criminal punishments are bigger. And it isn't true. Some criminal punishments are bigger. It's true that getting executed is worse than anything that happened to you as an individual through a tort judgment. On the other hand, losing $1 million is a lot worse than getting a traffic fine.
One of the things that was mentioned in our criminal law class is that we are now moved into a world in which there are quite a number of penalties that are imposed by the state, and they no longer require criminal intent. You are literally guilty simply because you did the crime. Your reasoning is irrelevant.
Yes, that is to say, my standard example of why I would say that intent is required in theory but not in practice is statutory rape. Because even if you did not know that the woman was underage, even if she showed you fake identification claiming to be the legal age, you are still in principle guilty. And that's a case where it seems to me you really have a strict liability crime.
Strict liability crimes are becoming increasingly
common. But then you can say, fine, go back 50 years. If you just think about the legal system, it would seem to me that obviously a large part of what you're doing for these 3 years is training to be lawyers. And that's not really the job. That's not really what I'm teaching. I mean, that's what many people are teaching you, and that's the main reason you're willing to pay the time and money for it. But presumably you're also being thinking human beings, trying to make sense of this world you're going to be functioning in. And that's, in some sense, what I think of myself, my job as being to help with, to understand legal systems, and that's what economic analysis of law is about, and that's what thinking about the implications of new technology is about, and that's what this course is really about. And from that standpoint, it just seems to me that all law students and all law professors ought at some point to have devoted some thought to why do we have both tort law and criminal law. And one of the best ways to do it, in my opinion, is to make this radical proposal. Let's just scrap criminal law entirely. Someone kills someone, fine, his kin sue him. You don't believe it can work? Go read the sagas. It's been done. And, yeah.
It seems like equal protection would be a huge issue with combining the two. Now you said that...
but remember, when I'm combining the two, I'm also adopting the Icelanders' idea of making tort claims marketable. So once tort claims are marketable, if you think about, again, forget about private deterrence for a moment. Just in a world where where the incentive is the claim. If the amount I can get out of you is less than the cost of convicting you, however rich I am, I'm not going to do it. If the amount I can get out of you is more than the cost of convicting you, I can sell it to somebody who will pay me some money, the difference, in order that he can convict you and collect the fine. So once you make tort crime towards marketable, now the problem of the poor defendant, of the poor plaintiff, which is the problem I usually start with when I'm discussing this, gets taken care of.
Standing.
No, you've got standing. You bought your standing. Right? Then, of course, that's what marketable torts are, right? What I'm suggesting by a marketable tort is a system where if I have a tort claim against you, I can freely transfer it to anybody else. And he then has the claim in my place. We have that with subrogation of insurance already. All right, subrogation and I'm not forgetting the term, but the law firm taking a case for a cut of the winnings are the two forms of transfer. Oh, and out-of-court settlements where you're selling your claim to the defendant. Those are the three versions of transferable tort in our legal system. Whereas all you have to do is generalize it and just say it's all to anybody, and now they have standing because they're you, legally speaking. So I think that. But I mean, it's interesting. That was sort of one of the first issues that occurred to me thinking about this. And I spend a chapter in Law's Order on what I call the crime tort puzzle. Yeah.
Wouldn't we also have a system developed then where you would market defense? So it would be essentially defendant insurance. Defendant sells his liability for a particular.
Interesting thought. Interesting thought. You might or might not. It's possible, but that's right. You can't do that now. Can you? Presumably, you can contract with a defense lawyer for a fixed payment for which he will defend you.
Yes.
So it doesn't have to be by the hour. What? Can you contract with somebody? You can't insure against liability, can you? But you can insure against tort liability, of course you can. You can't insure against criminal liability.
I remember when Borland had a contractual arrangement with a law firm prior to our being sued by Lotus relating to where they were going to handle our legal cases. And then when the Lotus case blew up, they lost tons of money on that case because that case dragged on for ages.
And it ended up 4-4 in the Supreme Court.
And that law firm ended up suing Borland because they said, this was a bad deal and we want to get out of it.
And
to help their feet
yes.
in the fire. And say,
I don't know if people, I was actually describing your case to somebody yesterday at Bolt where I was giving a talk, or maybe somewhere else. At some point recent in the last day, I was describing. This is a very famous case. You ought to know about it if you don't. Lotus v. Borland, because it's a high tech case. And the question was, Lotus had a spreadsheet which was the dominant spreadsheet at the time. Borland produced a spreadsheet which I gather was a better done spreadsheet. So they thought that that was their claim, and it was probably true. And they didn't copy the spreadsheet at all. They wrote it from scratch. What they copied was the menu tree. The sequence of commands by which you tell the thing what to do. So that I don't know what it was, but it was something like, control.
F2 is still the way in which you edit the cell. So you hit F2, and then you can hit, Control C, and then you can hit Alt A.
That kind of sequence. And Lotus claimed that violated their copyright. And so the question was, is the menu tree idea or expression, formally put? And who won just before the Supreme Court?
We did.
You won. So Borland did win. So that's how they got it. Because Borland won. And Lotus then appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court split 4-4.
Right.
So in a certain sense, the case was never determined. We never knew what the right answer would be. It's quite an important case because if you're doing intellectual property, the arguments, I think, for copyright law, when what you're talking about is copying a chapter of a book, are much cleaner than the argument for copyright law the way it gets used nowadays, when it covers not merely the text of a program, but some, but it's not clear what features of the program. So that, in effect, in the computer world, copyright has sort of oozed over towards patents. And since copyright has different rules for patent, that's a problem. But going back to the tort crime issue, it seems to me that there are at least three different questions that are worth asking, all three of which I discuss a bit in my chapter. I don't think I answered them. One of them is there a good reason to have both systems? One of them is, if you have both systems, is there a good reason why they have the different rules they do? And one is, if you have both systems, is there a good reason to sort offenses the way we do, such that certain things are treated as crimes and not torts, certain things torts and not crimes, certain things both? So going back to your suggestion, what you're suggesting is buying insurance against criminal liability. Is that right?
Not really. I mean, that system's probably going to exist regardless. What I was saying is that in a market where you can freely trade your
claim,
yes. It seems to me there would also be a system to develop that you could trade your
negative claim.
Your negative claim, yeah. And so it'd be post-hoc insurance, I suppose. And that, to me, if that system would develop, which it seems logical it would, that defeats the entire...
Why? Because after all, if all you're doing is limiting the uncertainty.
It defeats the deterrent purpose of...
Why? Why?
Because an executive with millions of dollars could ostensibly do whatever he wants.
We have two separate issues. One of them is the question of money punishments versus other punishments. And there you can make the argument you're just making. But that has nothing to do with the point you were just raising, because what's going to happen in that case is if there wasn't a market on the defendant's side, then I, the rich executive, say I have a 50% chance of paying a $2 million fine, 50% chance I win the case, and forget about the lawyer's fees. On average, I'm paying $1 million. If there is a market, I have to pay somebody $1 million to take over my negative claim. I pay $1 million. So all it's doing is eliminating the uncertainty. So that's not a problem that I can see.
But I'm talking about the deterrent effect of putting someone in jail.
I understand, but that's...
So a good example would be drug dealers. They will probably continue their trade if they're not physically restrained from doing that, so long as they're financially secure enough to just continue
to pay. I think it's safe to say the government would eliminate
his system isn't his point. Your point is a point about the money damages, not about the ability to then transfer it to somebody who's...
Those are two different things. But
that's right.
The point that I'm pointing out is that I think this system would develop if your system was permitted.
But that's it. All I'm saying is it might well develop. But it seems to me it is not, as I understand you, relevant to the critique you're raising about the system I'm describing, which is, look, the criticism you're giving would equally apply if we had straight criminal law, we just used entirely fines, what the Athenians mostly did, with a few exceptions. So your critique, it seems to me, is a critique about using fines, not a critique about privatizing the system. No?
Well, ostensibly, yes, that is what I'm making. My point is that when somebody opts for a fine instead of the probability, they are making...
Instead of a probability of a fine.
Right. So in your example, yep, paying $1 million
right,
instead of taking a 50%
right
chance of two. When they opt to pay the $1 million,
yep,
that is a higher value to them.
I understand,
for whatever reason, which means that this side of the scale... is no longer...
But you're assuming that $2 million is somehow fixed, locked in concrete. If we say the deterrence we want is the level of deterrence given by a 50% chance of paying $2 million, if it turns out that when they can eliminate the risk, that a 50% chance of paying $2 million is the equivalent of a certainty of paying $1.1 million, then we just raise the fine from $2 million to $2.2 million, and now their payment goes up. So that all we've done is, as I say, you have a legitimate point with regard to the money element. But the other element, all you're doing is reducing an inefficiency in the system, because when the government collects extra money from you, they get the extra money. When they collect a cost from you that consists of the fact that you're risk averse, they don't get anything out of it. So therefore, the government is better off if they maintain the deterrent effect constant by saying, if you're able to insure against the uncertainty, we will just scale up the punishment a little bit so that the insured version is now the equivalent of the uninsured version was. Yeah.
If based on that idea, I think the logical thing to do if you're wealthy is to contract out your liability to someone who is a judgment group. And then basically they're... So you can basically get away with things, and it's like now the cost is falling.
I understand, but that yes, but I agree. But I would say that such a legal system, that's not going to be a legal transfer, precisely because they can't pay it.
Yeah.
But going back though, it seems to me the substance of your point, which is really a complaint about money fines, and I think not a complaint. And I actually have an article, if you're curious, up on my webpage entitled "Should the Rich Pay Higher Fines?" And that's an attempt to explore from a law and econ standpoint the question of whether the argument that a fine that will deter a poor person won't deter a rich person.
So they do that in Finland, right? You know,
they do that. They do it in Finland, and they do it at least one of the other European countries.
Somebody,
I forget where.
Yeah,
one of the Nokia executives ended up with like $1 million. Something. Yeah. So
that they go, well, it's not deterring you to pay a $40 fine, but a $1 million fine will deter.
I think the Finnish system, it's a percentage of your income, if I remember correctly. frankly. And there's at least one of the other European countries, I forget which does that as well. But as, if you're curious, I have a in terms of the law and econ analysis, I have a theoretical argument, which came out of the fact that when I was originally teaching this stuff, my response was, but there's nothing wrong with that, because after all, if the rich person, if committing this offense is worth $1,000 to a rich person, and it imposes only a $500 cost on someone else, then on net we're better off letting them do it. And my students didn't agree with that result. And I thought about it more and eventually concluded that I was wrong, that there were some circumstances in which it made sense to have the same money punishment for rich and poor, and some circumstances in which it did not make sense to have the same money punishment. And it's complicated enough, so I'm not going to go into it here, but as if you're curious, the web page is, the article is up on my webpage on just that subject.
So would you take the position that the monetary punishment scheme is in fact not a successful scheme? I mean,
No. What I'm saying is that depending on the circumstances, having to do in part with the nature of the offense, there are going to be some cases where it makes sense to have the fine independent of the wealth or income of the offender, and the other cases in which you have good enough information you would want to make it depend on the wealth or income of the offender. But
getting back to the discussion we had last time,
yep.
With the costs of punishment being really substantial in historic terms,
yes.
It seems to me what's going on in society, if I can generalize, is that societies essentially take the position that murder is bad, what a surprise, but they say we don't want to invest in the cost of creating jails, and we don't want to basically kill people every time a murder is committed, because that generates this unending cycle, as we see with the Finnish Kala. And so instead we say we're going to assign a very, very large value to human life, and we're going to discourage people from committing murder by essentially allowing this fine to be paid as a way to, you know, if you don't pay the fine, then we're going to kill you, and so justice is perceived to be done, and therefore we hopefully avoid a feud starting, because essentially it's, you know, the state is, but sort of, so we didn't have to build this elaborate prison system, because people don't want to be killed, and they bring in all their friends and family, who jointly get together and pay the stupendous fine of 99 camels, or whatever it is, 8 female slaves, but they're so beholden to their relatives in order to pull this thing off, that it's very, very discouraged in society to ever do this. I mean, it's like, oh, you kill someone, yep. You're all going to eat bankrupt, and the result, and stop. Don't do that.
One of the points made in the Somali stuff is that one of the things that the DIA paying group could do is to say to this member, if you want to stay in this group, you are constrained in the following fashion. You don't carry your AK-47 anymore, because we don't have to pay the next time you shoot somebody. So that was, it was a mechanism along those lines, where you were getting incentives for the people around him to, in effect, enforce the rules. Yo, I'm sorry.
Well, I was thinking the separation of the two also helps limit the amount of government that's involved in the judicial process.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a criminal system, the government is involved in basically what they've decided they want to be involved in, which are horrible crimes. But then they set up this tort system that's just, you know, if you want to bring a charge to someone that falls in a statute, that someone violated a statute, then you can choose to bring it in your forum, but...
But that's an argument for why, if you had a pure crime system, you'd want to invent tort. It doesn't tell us why, if you have a pure tort system, you want to invent crime. Because the pure tort system gets the government even further out of it. And in fact, when I'm making arguments in favor of the elimination, one of the points I pretty routinely make is that one of the dangers of a criminal system is that because the state controls it, if you're a friend of the state, you can get away with murder. They choose not to prosecute. And I run through some real-world cases in the U.S., the Black Panther shooting in Chicago when I was a graduate student there, and a bunch of police come to the door of an apartment at night, and they open fire through the walls, and they kill 2 people, and none of them is ever charged with any crime. And the...
So the combined system would be non-governmental? It would be...
Yes.
Well, what depends. What I'm discussing now is governmental in the sense the government is still running the courts and enforcing the verdicts. So it's more governmental than a real feud system. If you think of the Roman child or the Somali, where there really is no government. It's even more governmental than the Icelandic, where there is a government court and legislature, but no government enforcement. but it is less governmental than our present one, because I'm imagining a system in which, instead of having our present system in which for crimes the prosecution part is taken over by the government, and the as well as the punishment, and for torts the prosecution is private but the court and the punishment are public, you would have one in which the prosecution was private for everything. That would be what I think of as my moderate proposal, as opposed to the full-blown proposal which I discussed in my first book, where I was sketching out a system in which we had no government and essentially had a modern equivalent of a feud system, so to speak, which is a more interesting, weirder idea. Yeah.
In the tort-only system, how do you address the problem? Well, two problems that I see. Crimes that where the victim would not want to press charges, but there is a big state interest in charging a person for like domestic violence or rape or what have you. And then what about in the circumstance where a party would want to remain anonymous?
The latter one is interesting, but presumably you could, in the latter case, you could transfer your claim. You could certainly, maybe if that was a common situation, I don't know if it is, but imagine it is, you could have institutions in which there was some way of verifying you had transferred the claim. I'm thinking now, actually, it's entirely different subject, but it happened to come up my other class Monday, which is the institutions that have been set up for trying to prevent the problem of Tay-Sachs disease. Tay-Sachs is a genetic disease, which is a recessive that does no harm to carriers, but if two carriers marry, they've got one chance in four of having a child that has the disease. And there is a private organization, organized, I think, by Orthodox Jews, because Tay-Sachs gene is one of the few populations where it's common is Jews, where you get tested, you are given a number, your serial number, as it were, and the information about the test only exists under that serial number. So that at the point when you get the number, you don't know if you're a carrier, and they don't know if you're a carrier, they don't know who you are. Now, when a couple are thinking of getting married, they send their two numbers to the organization, and the organization says yes or no. You are or are not two carriers. So you could imagine, I think, some set of, in a public system, from the governmental institutions, in which there is a way in which I can prove that I'm the claimant without my transfer. But you've still got the problem in both the present and the in both systems, currently the present system. It's going to be real hard to convict somebody if the victim isn't going to testify, and it's hard to stay anonymous when you're testifying, right? Especially since the defendant has got the right to cross-examine people that he tells. Yeah. So I'm not. That's an interesting question, and so I have never thought about it before. And my guess is it's not a big difference between the two systems, but I could be wrong. But your first one, I guess my answer would be that I regard 98% of the claim that crimes are injuries to the state as bogus. That it seems to me pretty clear that when I get mugged, I'm the one who got hurt, not Jerry Brown. And that one of my interpretations, I don't really know, but the relevant history is that you're starting out with an Anglo-Saxon legal system in which in its early period is not too far from the Icelandic, in which essentially all crimes are thought of as offenses against specific individuals who get collect damages for it. Over time, first under the Anglo-Saxons and then under the Normans, more and more offenses are treated as both an offense against the victim and against the king, which has the useful characteristic that the king gets a cut of the damage payment, and eventually are becoming only offenses against the king. And I regard that as having been a revenue grab at the time. It was just there was all this money lying around which was going to victims, and why let the money go to victims when the king could have it? But maybe I'm wrong. So it seems to me that I find it hard to think of a case. I mean, almost everything people do has some effect on other people. But given that we don't have a good mechanism for sort of making grand decisions for the world, I think a very sensible rule is to say, as long as most of the cost or most of the benefit goes to an identified person, treat it as if it was all of it. Because that person then can make the decisions, he'll usually make the right decision. And from that standpoint, it seems to me that when I am robbed, there is very little cost to the state of California, and there's a lot of cost to me.
That's not really the argument.
What are the cases you're thinking of then?
I was not saying that it's a crime against the state.
Yes.
What I'm saying is that it is a crime that would be worth prosecuting for a deterrent effect against other potential offenders or against this particular one. The example I brought up would be, I think, domestic violence and rape of victims. Now, of course, you're going to have problems when they're not going to testify, but I would bet that a study of victims who said, know, the state can protect you. You know, there, you have a big guy in your corner now. I imagine that that's a very persuasive way to get these people to testify. And if you no longer have power of the state, the police backing, the restraining orders, etc., that persuade someone to testify, the incidence of reports and prosecution seems to me like it would go down.
Might be. I'm not sure if it's an adequate answer, but it seems to be a possible answer, is that what the victim does is to transfer the claim to a large, well-organized organization, sort of a big law firm. And the big law firm then says, look, now we're in your corner. We, after all, want to collect this damage payment. And so if he threatens you, we'll take further legal action. If necessary, we'll get a private guard to keep an eye on you and so forth. So I'm not sure that your problem can be dealt with. But I agree, it's an interesting problem. Because the ones I was thinking of was the claim which underlies the whole criminal law that crimes are offenses primarily against some of the other than the victim. And that just seems to me is very, very rarely true. Now, of course, in the case of drug dealing, it's sort of a side issue. I mean, I'm in favor of drug dealing. I think it should be legal. I think that the war on drugs is itself a crime in the moral sense and a much larger crime than any others I can think of, since it puts a million people in jail.
What about traffic violations? Like how does a tort system punish someone for speeding?
I'm not sure I see the problem. That is to say, somebody owns the road. If the state owns the road, then speeding is indeed a tort committed against the state. The state can sue in courts like anybody else. If roads are private, if we imagine a system has gone much farther in the direction I would like than what we've actually been talking about so far, then the private owner of the road says, look, when you come on this road, we've got this posted thing saying the contract on what you're agreeing to is available at webpage so-and-so. Don't come onto this road unless you've read that and make sure you agree to it. And if you've agreed to it, we will sue you for damages for breach of contract, because one term of the contract was that you agreed not to drive faster than 80 miles an hour on our road. So I'm not sure that would be such a problem. I mean, certainly if you imagine a society with no government at all, there are all sorts of interesting problems that arise, and some of them can be solved and some of them can't. But then a society with government, there are a whole lot of problems that arise, and some of them can be solved and some of them can't. In a sense, sort of from my perspective, one of the stronger arguments for eliminating criminal law is that in criminal law, in practice, the state is on all sides of the case. That the state is the state is the prosecutor, the state is the judge, and the state probably appointed the attorney for the defendant, because most defendants are indigent. And that strikes me as a very dangerous kind of situation if you happen to be a defendant who the state doesn't like. And I would like to believe that I live in a world where things like that never happen, but I think the historical evidence is that I don't. So that would be a longer thing than going beyond this. But the chapter covered a lot of other stuff, but I do think that the whole crime tort issue is quite a fascinating issue. And getting away for a moment from the question of whether you could replace criminal law with tort law, just the question, does it make sense to have these different rules? Is there a reason why we need it for one and not for the other? Yeah.
So you don't believe that any motivation for making the crimes against the state, any part of the motivation was to ensure that everyone was
I don't know. I mean, at the time when this decision was making, they still had benefit of clergy. So if a cleric killed you, he got out of the royal court system. So it's not fair that they... I mean, you're talking about a transition that occurred, I think, at a time long before the idea that everybody has the same rights became popular. That after all, women didn't have the same rights for a very long time. Jews didn't have the same rights. So I may be wrong, but my guess is that the original... And obviously I could be wrong. My guess is that the original shift back in sort of starting in some point during the Anglo-Saxon period was a revenue grab. I could be wrong, but that seems to be the most plausible guess. And one of the puzzling things, which I really don't have good answers to, is how you get that shift occurring early on. But by the 18th century, the crown is still in paper claiming that these are all offenses against the crown, but the crown not only isn't prosecuting them, but to some extent it's collecting damages, because it's collecting slave labor. It's making people volunteer for the Navy in order not to get hanged, so I guess it's getting some benefit. But it looks somehow as though it's gotten into the hands of the crown and then out of the hands of the crown to a considerable extent. Incidentally, I should mention, because it's relevant in a sense to your question, that in principle, a tort system doesn't have to be limited to money damages. Of course, ours isn't limited because you've got restraining orders. But in fact, in English law, there was something called an appeal of felony, which was a private action where the ultimate outcome was execution. So that was a private suit claiming somebody had committed an offense which should be executed. And Blackstone discusses it in the 18th century, and Blackstone says this is now no longer in practice being done, but it's still on the books. And he says if someone were convicted in an appeal of felony, the Crown could not pardon him because the Crown wasn't a party to the suit. Which I thought was sort of quite an interesting attitude, way of looking at imagining a system which was a privately prosecuted system that was really private rather than the 18th century system which was privately prosecuted but legally speaking was still the Crown. Yeah?
Out of curiosity in that, who does the physical execution?
I do not know. It's a good question. But I should say that I gather some of that still exists in English law. Because there was a high-profile case some time ago where I think a gang of boys killed somebody and the police decided not to prosecute, presumably because they didn't think they had good enough evidence on who did it. And a group of people, I think including the relatives of the victim, did a criminal prosecution which apparently is still possible, though very uncommon under English law, but failed to get a conviction. And quite recently that case was revived. It was a high-profile case. And the news stories I saw seemed to claim that the English legal system had abandoned the rule against double jeopardy. Now, I don't know if it's right. This is a news story, obviously not. But the claim seemed to be that these people had been acquitted in the private case. And now a public case had been made against them. I think one of them had gotten convicted, if I remember correctly. Now, maybe what was really going on was the rule against double jeopardy didn't apply when it was a private prosecution. Because, after all, O.J. wasn't protected by double jeopardy from having both a criminal and a tort case against him. So maybe that's what happened. I don't know. But the news story made it sound as though England had abandoned the rule against double jeopardy, which is a pity. Right. Other people? Thank you.
Two months into the class, and we've managed to actually get them into real debate on the